Well, good evening, listeners. This is Dr. Gianni Hayes with the show, The New World Order Disorder, and my co-host is Brian Davis. Hey, hey, Brian.
How you doing, Gianni?
I'm hanging in there. How about you? Hey, we got through that, whatever that thing was with the black holes they might make.
Yeah, we didn't blow up. Go figure.
But you're listening to the American Voice Radio Network, and we are heard all over the world. Are we not, Brian?
Yes, ma'am, we are.
And some of the ways that people can listen to us, and I'm going to let you do that tonight because every week I do that, and you can start, and I will give the first one, and then you could do the whole bit.
Well, okay, let's do it.
All right. One, of course, is through the phone bridge, which is 218-486-7200, and as soon as an automated voice comes on, you punch in 361113. And you can hear the show on the phone if you can't get us any of the other ways that Brian's going to tell you.
All right. Well, you can also get us on the Internet. If you're listening there now, you already know how to get to us. There's also AM and FM across the country. And KU-band satellite, Galaxy 25, Telstar 5, Transponder 5, frequency 11836. And I think that pretty much covers it. Did I leave anything out?
Now, iPods.
Well, we do have the archive on the radio station.
Right, and people can download us on their cell phones, and they can get us on shortwave radio.
Shortwave, that's a new one for me, okay.
Yeah, well, at least for me, that's what I've been told, and I understand people are loading the show on their cell phones as well. And, hey, we have a chat room, listeners, and all you have to do is go to the American Voice radio.com, and at the top of the right side of the page it says chat room. Click on there, put any name that you want in the browser. Make up a name if you want. You don't even have to put a password, and click login, and voila, you are in the chat room. There's already some people in there, and within the next 15 minutes it will be loaded, and you can try to ask Brian and me some questions, and we'll do our very best to answer them. Please also check out my sites, which is creative-services.biz, as well as AmericanDDC.com. That's American Drug Testing Consultants.com for any of your drug testing needs for home or work. So you can certainly go to that. And don't forget to buy your cell phone filters from Frank on American Voice Radio. And you really need those to protect against radiation, because Brian and I have done a ton of shows now on cell phone radiation. And I guess that covers everything. Oh, I know. What is our call-in number? It's toll-free, Brian.
Our call-in number. And, wow, if I'd have been looking, if I'd known I was
1-800-433-1429.
It takes me a second to get to that computer string when you catch me like that.
I know. I always love to catch you off guard.
I'm running about six different windows over here trying to monitor the chat room, the website, and
oh, poor baby.
The stream.
Like, so. I'm not, right?
Yeah, that's right. You're not.
That reminds us, Brian, we should tell people if they want to know about our guests, past, present, and future.
Oh, yeah.
Go to this great website that Brian does for us, and it's GianniHayes.net. That's all, Gianni, G-I-A-N-N-I, Hayes.net. Now, Brian, I'm going to give you a choice. You want to read the first guest or the second guest?
I'll start with the first one. Might as well get it over with early.
Okay, go right ahead.
Okay, I do want to encourage people. For this guest, go to our website, GianniHayes.net, and you will have a link to tonight's guest, and that is www.drjudywood.com. What you're going to see, and I will tell you, if you're on dial-up, it may be a little bit intensive, but on high speed, you'll be fine. She has a massive amount of photography, video, things from 9/11 that we're going to be discussing tonight. And it will be probably beneficial to everyone to actually be able to see that while she's speaking. Anyway, our guest tonight, Judy Wood, is a former professor of mechanical engineering with research interest in experimental stress analysis, structural mechanics, optical methods, deformation analysis, and materials characterization of biomaterials and composite materials. That's a mouthful. It really is. She's a member of the Society for Experimental Mechanics, co-founded the Society's Biological Systems and Materials Division, and currently serves on the, it's abbreviated SEM, she serves on the SEM Composite Materials technical division and received her BS in civil engineering, an MS in engineering mechanics and applied physics, and a PhD in materials engineering science from the Department of Engineering and
I can always count on you, Brian.
You know it. I just love to keep you in stitches. You and between you and Frank, I'll never live this down. This is going to be the rest of my life. Engineering science and mechanics at Virginia Polytechnic Institute and State University in Blacksburg, Virginia. Anyway, her dissertation involved the development of an experimental method to measure thermal stresses in bimaterial joints, and she's taught courses including experimental stress analysis, engineering mechanics, mechanics of materials, and strength of materials testing. And I tell you what, I had a chance to interview Dr. Wood before the show to get an idea of what we're going to be going over tonight. She blew me away.
Yeah?
Yeah. So
That's what I have you do, is to get all that information so you can blow us away.
You know, I found Dr. Wood's site, about a year and a half ago, and she was transitioning at the time. I was thrilled when you found her, but I talked to her, and we're about to find out. I mean, this stuff, I thought with an engineering background that I had an idea of what was going on. She blew me away. This is going to be fun. Dr. Wood, are you with us?
Yes, I am.
Welcome. Yes, welcome
to
the show.
I'm glad to be here.
Well, you know, this is our 9/11 show, and we're doing this all month long, Dr. Wood, and we've got you here tonight because Brian and I know you have some special information that you would like to share with the listeners, so we're going to let you get started, and then I know that Brian had done the screening of you, and he can certainly jump in at any time, and I certainly will as well, so go right ahead.
Well, I tell you what, I will start her off in a direction. Dr. Wood, you and I talked before the show, and in order to get things kicked off, because we've only got an hour and a lot of material to cover, I'd like to start off leading into what we talked about with molecular dissemination and some of the other things. But in order to get there, what I'd like to start is, what do you think did or did not happen on 9/11 as far as the buildings are concerned, and why do you think these things?
Yeah, that's a very good way to put it. If you go to my homepage, it's drjudywood.com, drjudywood.com. I'm trying to move to a new homepage that's less cluttered, but right now there's a whole lot of thumbnails and accidentally clicking on different pages. There's the first row of a lot of pictures. On the right-hand end, there's a picture that was taken. It's kind of small, but it's looking kind of north-northwest. It's taken in the afternoon, or around noon, maybe it's before noon, on 9/11. We know what day it is because Building 7 is still standing. But there should be a tower between us and Building 7. We see just flat ground. Where'd the building go? That's the first thing to notice. And noticing and observing is one of the greatest key features to all of this. We're told what to believe and what not to believe, and what to think, what not to think. Just open your eyes and observe yourself, and you start seeing a whole lot of things. But the greatest secret is, where'd the building go? There's two 110-story buildings, 500,000 tons each, that just went away in 8 or 10 seconds. That's phenomenal. Something just so bizarre had to have occurred. So what did or didn't happen? Well, right off the bat, we see some buildings went away. They were there that morning, but by noon they were gone, so we know that much. And I think it's so important to not make assumptions. We heard planes hit the tower, so therefore they had to have. Or we heard that it was 19 bad guys with box cutters, so therefore that's a given fact. And just start over and open your eyes and just look. And that's actually kind of fun. You look and you see more and more, and it opens a wide world.
So what do you think then happened? I mean, you refer to the fact that the buildings were there, then they're gone, and of course all of us have been fed this information that planes took it down. What are you thinking?
Well, first of all, the story we were given was that planes went in and made these cookie cutter holes in the sides. I think anyone who knows much about physics or has done anything themselves knows that that doesn't happen. It's kind of like you throw a baseball through a window. It doesn't make a baseball-shaped hole. It makes, you know, it crashes in this spiderweb kind of pattern of breakage of glass. You know, various things happen. But what got me on that day was the upper right, you know, wing entry hole. It's a little slot, 5 inches thick. Aluminum making a slice through a steel beam and leaving no scraps on the ground. I showed that to another engineering professor, and they jaw dropped, and they said, something's wrong with the story we were given. Now, you just look at it, you know. We've all seen Roadrunner cartoons. We laugh at them. Young children laugh at them. Why? Because they're impossible. Things like that just don't happen.
Okay, so I guess in order to kind of cut to the chase to get some of the other items we talked about, do you think bombs went off, thermite, holograms? What do you think it was, maybe?
The biggest tendency here is for people to jump to the answer and then look for the evidence to support it. And I guarantee you, if I think we all know this is a psyops. And if it's a psyops, you know that's not going to work because you're missing, you know, you're overlooking something you shouldn't. And look at it kind of like a scavenger hunt. You know, what works, what doesn't work. When can you discard a particular idea? I won't, you know, immediately jump to answers, but I can eliminate, you know, big bombs going off like nukes. You have all this unburned paper, and I think everyone can remember all the unburned paper all over the place. So you can't have some huge heat that would, because it would be burning. But there's an interesting, whoa, some kitties doing something. But there are some interesting images we've seen with what appears to be glowing metal,
mm-hmm.
and we're told that that's hot. And we see fumes coming up, and we're told that's smoke. And when I developed this new vocabulary for these things, I did so to keep myself from being biased, because if you call it smoke, you're assuming it's a fire. And, okay, you see fumes coming up. That just described that phenomenon. But there's this glowing metal look that's bizarre. And, okay, it's particularly what I call the Cheeto picture. It looks like old Cheeto on the ground, an orange curl, but maybe it's a piece of steel pipe.
Mm-hmm.
You look at that, and either that picture is fake or the glowing stuff is not hot. That's the conclusion I come to with that.
Now, why would you say if it's glowing orange that it's not hot? I mean, or what would make you think
it's fake?
Either
a fake picture or it's not hot.
Right, but what would lead you to believe that?
Well, it's the hydraulic equipment that's holding it. And if you look on my home page, it's in that second row, right in the middle. You see, I call it, generically call them diggers. Some of the earth-moving equipment's holding something up. And below that, you see some other weird fire pictures. This digger is holding it up, so the thing's operational. It, right behind that jaw is, you know, hydraulics. That can't. It has a very narrow window of operation. It's kind of like your car engine. Your car engine is going to operate at 1,000 degrees. You know, it's just got this window of temperature. But in addition to that, if that thing is near melting temperature, how did the digger get it out of the ground? It had to dig down in there for a while. Why isn't the digger melted? But also, why isn't the hydraulics locked up? And then once it picks this thing up, why is it picking it up? Where is it going to take it? To the dumpster? You know, it doesn't make sense. But if you think of it as, you know, at first I thought it might be a fake picture, but now I'm thinking it's real. Because I've seen other evidence, and I can explain it. It's a particular phenomenon that comes from this molecular dissociation process.
Okay.
But before I knew about that, I'd been just noting that picture. Okay, we got something weird going on here.
in order to get into the molecular dissociation. Can you explain what that is to the people that are listening?
Molecules, when you have a chunk of steel, all the molecules are stuck to each other in there. They're attached. They're attracted to each other. They're bonded together. And if for some weird reason they suddenly decide to start repelling each other, the material just breaks down and turns to dust. And that's something that I am absolutely sure with. There's a particular picture that I call it the fuzzball intersection. There's a intersection about a block north of the complex. So, and the wind was blowing southward. It's after both towers have gone. It's just long enough for the air to clear out. And you see a clear blue sky. The dust has obviously settled out to the ground. But then you notice around these people's feet, some firefighters and some policemen, these fuzzballs. It's just like this fuzzy, real fine, super fine dust. And wait a minute. How could that have settled out of the air in like 10 minutes? And then pretty soon you notice it's coming up all by itself. And the streets look like they're fuming. And then they bring in the street cleaners and scrub them down. I started noticing this process. And that's when it became quite apparent. You had to have coarse dust settle out of the air that quickly. And after it settled out, it became fine dust. How does that happen?
Well, I'm also noticing the quantity of dust in the pictures. It looks like it engulfs the whole city. Yeah, I mean, just for the pictures.
I think it's funny that with the Seattle Times, when talking about the Kingdome, the Seattle Kingdome, they blew up with dynamite, controlled demolition. Oh, it filled all of downtown with dust for almost 20 minutes. It's kind of funny, by contrast, I mean, the dust just was gone after 20 minutes, and it didn't go higher than the highest point of the Kingdome. And what we saw in Manhattan went up and up and up into the upper atmosphere. And that was another puzzling thing. Why would it go up?
Well, as far as the dust goes, in a standard building collapse, would that much dust be created? I mean, you would think you would have just chunks of stuff, not fine dust.
Right. I've been looking at the websites of some of the contractors for the NIST report,
mm-hmm.
and there's one of them that looks into explosives, and they make buildings, yeah, and they have test structures that they blow up, and concrete facilities, and you see they have big chunks, little chunks, in between size chunks when they do their tests. They don't have powder. But we didn't see big chunks, small chunks, and between size chunks. We saw fairly uniform looking powder. Well, uniform, below a certain range. I mean, there were no golf ball size pieces and bigger.
Okay.
What about the cars that in your site, I know you talked about it, seemed as though they had spontaneously combusted.
And again, it's not from heat. It's not a regular fire.
These were cars that were quite a distance from the towers.
Yeah, there's all sorts of distances. And, like, there's a parking lot several blocks away northwest of the towers, and there's a sea of paper in between that didn't catch fire.
Mm-hmm.
And the cars were doing whatever they're doing, this weird toasting process. And it was that was another aha moment, is over on FDR Drive, I was noticing this police car, which looked like it kind of sagged in the middle. One place was really toasted looking, and one nanometer to the right of it, pristine condition, new wax job. That's not a regular fire. A fire would have hot, medium hot, cooler. They would have a gradation. This was a very fine line, and with my background in optics, that looked like, two-beam interference, where you have constructive and destructive interference, where you would have something happen in one place and not another.
So to kind of tie this together, What does this affect? What are a few of the other things that would be seen, and what do you think could cause something like this?
Well, we have upside-down cars. They parked in the regular place, except they're upside down. Quite a few of those. And with trees fully covered with leaves right next to it. There's glass is all blown out of the WFC buildings, but no stab wounds in the buildings, no projectiles, apparently. Particular materials were affected, like all of the marble facade around the entrances, but not the rest of the facade. And when you start looking at effects on one type of material and not another, that's a directed type of energy. Hmm. If it's just a kinetic energy device, it explodes and, you know, stuff goes flying in all directions. It doesn't care what it's tearing apart.
You say a directed kind of energy, like a special beam of energy?
Yes, directed energy is a very, very broad field. It's my definition of it is energy that's directed, but DEW, energy that's directed and is used as a weapon.
Mm-hmm.
Directed energy weapons. That could be anywhere from a taser to something that causes the Twin Towers to go poof in 8 seconds. But, you know, it's like saying weapons. There's a whole lot, big category of weapons. It's anywhere from a BB gun to a rubber band to, you know, bombs. So, yeah, it's a very general category. But it has to be an energy weapon, but it also has to be directed, because we saw cylindrical holes in buildings. Like, all of the middle of Building 6 disappeared. It looked like somebody took a post hole digger and dug out cylindrical cutouts, removing about 50% of the mass of it.
Wow, so that's interesting you say that maybe it potentially is a directed energy beam of some type. Then that certainly gives cause for intentional.
Yeah, by somebody. We don't know, but who.
Right.
But I try to stay away from the end point, because if you get in too big of a hurry, you miss the scenery along the way.
Mm-hmm.
And there's so much to learn from this. The biggest thing is that something horrendous happened that day. You look at the material, something unbelievable. Whatever it was, we should study it, because there's so many good things we can do with it. We can use it for good purposes. And it was very much horrendous. And it didn't just happen that day. Do you realize it's still happening?
In what regard?
Well, I was there in January, and the material is still breaking down.
You had mentioned that in our pre-show interview. You had mentioned that immediately after 9/11, the dump trucks came in. Can you tell us a little bit about what that was and kind of lead into that?
Yeah, Rudy Giuliani, the next morning on a radio station, was bragging about how he had 120 dump trucks going in and out of the city all night. He claimed it was taking debris out, but what are you doing hauling debris out before you found the survivors?
Mm-hmm.
Because as soon as you start moving things around, you crush somebody. And then the pictures that I saw that were taken on the morning of the 12th, big piles of brand new dirt dumped on things. So I can put two and two together. It seems like if you had dump trucks coming and going all night, saying that they were moving debris, then people could ask them questions. They say, okay, that's why we saw trucks all night. I do have photographs of trucks coming into town, dump trucks, you know, big convoy of them. That picture was from the 23rd.
Can we backtrack, Judy, just for a minute? Because you started to say something that we got a little bit off of. But you said it is still breaking down. And I find this interesting. And can you tell us in what ways it's breaking down and what are the ramifications of that? What does that mean to the general public?
Okay, let's go back to where I noticed the dust had settled out of the air, and then it got finer and finer and started rising up. And then I noticed that they brought in street cleaners the afternoon of 9/11 to scrub the streets, because somebody might notice this fuming coming up, and they can't say that's molten metal because it's all over Manhattan. But there's this problem with the lawns. They have some, you know, grass growing in the front of WFC 2 and 3, and one, and they were fuming. So what do you do with those? Enter the dirt trucks. They put wet potting soil, or I assume that's what it is, it's what it looked like, all over the lawns. Then a few weeks later, scoop it up and bring in some more. And it's like changing diapers, or, you know, like a sponge soaking up something and taking it out and bringing in new dirt. And it's because some process is ongoing. Now, the Bankers Trust building, I don't know if you realize they repaired it. They had that gash in the front. And they repaired the gash, putting in new steel beams. But then they realized it was ongoing. It was still breaking down. And they decided they better take the building apart. So they started taking it apart, and they, you know, more problems. And it's still like halfway down, I think. But they got down to where they, that area where they'd replaced the beams. And they're just super rusty now. This is terrific amount of rust. It looks like they've been sitting in the bottom of the ocean for 100 years.
We're going to take a quick break on that note. Judy, just kind of sit tight, Brian. We're going to come right back after station identification. All right, listeners, this is Dr. Gianni Hayes, and we are back, Brian and I, with our 9/11 show for the month, and we have a super guest, Dr. Judy Wood is on, and we are talking about what really went on in 9/11. Judy, one of the things that I do know, having talked to many physicists myself, is that when you look at something that happened, such as 9/11, you certainly take into consideration the structural data and the ground shaking and visually what has transpired. But was there any indication on a seismic scale of the shaking of those buildings?
Very, very little. I've done an analysis on that as well early on. It mentioned the King Dome. The King Dome was 1/30th. That's 3-0, 15 times 2.
Mm-hmm.
1/30th of the potential energy of the towers. Yet it made a bigger bang on the ground than the South Tower. It made the same bang on the ground that the North Tower did, a 2.3.
Now, you also mentioned that the King Dome was on dirt and that the high-rise towers were actually on bedrock and should have been even more amplified because of that.
Correct. They should have rang like a bell. And the seismograph station at Lamont Doherty is on the same bedrock. Yeah, nice direct ring right over there.
You had mentioned that had bombs or something that big have gone off, it could have broken the bedrock and flooded the tub? Is that, you
well,
mentioned
if,
something
if,
about that?
Yeah, if a 500,000 ton, each of those towers are 500,000 tons, if they had slammed to the bedrock and that big of a bang had hit, it would have broken the bathtub. And the basement, the bottom seven floors of the tower down to bedrock are below the water table. And so there's this water retaining wall built around there. There's also the PATH train tunnels go under the Hudson and up to the bottom of the bathtub. And you would have flooded all of the subway tunnels and the PATH train tunnels. Big problems.
Listeners, we're at 1-800-433-1429. Feel free to call in and talk to Dr. Judy Wood. What about, you said no nukes, and I think you're absolutely right about that, but what about smaller explosives planted throughout both buildings?
Well, if you have a whole lot of explosives in the list, I wouldn't have any idea how you could remote control them because, you know, you go to blasting sites, just turn off cell phones. But let's say that you've managed to get them all in sequence and whatnot, but you get all those pieces of beams, you break them loose, they still have to go bang down to the ground. The ground did not experience that big bang.
Now, you had mentioned early on with this molecular dissociation that it goes back to the electron spin, and when you get them spinning the wrong way, now this is partly from our discussion before the show, when you get them spinning the wrong way, it's like taking two magnets that are holding each other together and all of a sudden turning one, it just wants to fall off. And you had said that you have seen experiments of this that have been done in steel, aluminum, concrete, and it had different effects. Can you tell us about some of the effects on steel and of course, the concrete, I guess, you know, fairly obvious, but tell us a little bit about that. What happened to all that stuff?
Various things have. I've seen actual samples that someone has made on a very, very small scale. But the amount of energy they use is even smaller, like the amount of a 75-watt light bulb. It turns a piece of a 2-inch by 3-inch cross-section of aluminum rod or aluminum bar to dust. It makes it explode from the inside out. And what the aha moment looking at the South Tower, when it starts to have that tipping top, it looks like all of the material, instead of the molecules attracting each other, suddenly repel each other, as though it's turning into steam, like water turning into steam. When water becomes steam, it expands in volume by 1,600 times. And I've been studying that when I looked at this picture of the tipping top of the South Tower. And I'm like, wait a minute, is there a way you can do that with solid material? Because it sure looks like that. And then I found the work of John Hutchison, who just sort of does this, you know, kind of as a hobby. It's a fun thing to do. He isn't doing it for anything. As a matter of fact, he won't do it for a government that wants to use it as weapons. But he did have the U.S. government in his lab in 1983 for 4 months, filming everything he did, taking, you know, careful notes. Somebody from Los Alamos was there, and the Pentagon. And it's kind of interesting. I wonder what they had, why they wanted to watch it. But, yeah, it does different things to different materials. And when before then, I had made this big list of all of the evidence I'd noticed, all of the phenomena. When I started looking at John Hutchison's work and reading technical articles that others have written about it, it was unbelievable that every single one of these phenomena were accounted for.
Mm-hmm. We have a question in the chat room, Judy. It says, please ask her if she has seen the video September Clues with actual newscast broadcast on 9/11, which has lots of evidence that there were no planes. Also, it has nothing to do with holograms. I think they use computers to do it on TV to make the fake planes, that is, blue-green screen technology or computer programs. They can do anything with that and use it all the time for TV and movies. Thanks.
Okay, I don't like to argue opinion so much. It's I'd rather discuss evidence and what evidence we can see and feel and touch.
So do you think it was a plane or a missile that hit or something different based on your evidence?
Or a hologram.
If we're going to jump to the opinion, we skip the evidence. But the subtleties I have noticed in the video footage is that the lighting is not right. And I've worked with optics a lot and know that lighting isn't right when you're, using diffraction gratings or using some kind of optical coating of things. You can coat a surface that has zero reflectance. Yeah, weird things like that. I also know that technology is available that they can project images. In 1999, in the Washington Post, there was an article, public domain. There was an article called When Seeing is Not Believing. They were discussing projecting a big image of Allah over Baghdad to scare people or get them to do something. This technology was available in 1999, and it was probably 20 years before that if they're talking about it in 1999. Because, they're always 20 years ahead of what they're telling you.
Mm-hmm.
So we know the technology is available for that. You can pick various options. I've not gotten into the plane thing so much because, I know planes didn't make those holes. Planes didn't make the towers go poof. And, it was sort of like the getaway car. It was a cover-up for the real crime. But I haven't felt the need to sort out all those details and, go off on that wild goose chase. There's enough people looking into that. But there wasn't anyone looking into, where'd the buildings go? We just see powder down there. The pictures taken right afterwards, they're ground level. The rescue workers walked horizontally or rappelled down into caverns.
But you keep saying, where did the buildings go? If we believe what we see on TV, and again, I use that as a major caveat, did they not go to total ash and actually a form of vaporization just from whatever heat it was?
There's no evidence of high heat. I've seen no evidence of high heat. To the contrary.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have people, like, if you made a big, grill, backyard grill, and you shrunk down to small size, could you walk over that grill and stand on it? You wear mitts to reach in your oven because it's hot. You wouldn't have people walking around there, and you wouldn't have the equipment working. You wouldn't have puddles of water in it. There's a picture at the basement of Tower 2. There's just this puddle at the bottom of an empty hole.
Okay. I want to come back to the high heat in just a minute, but we have a caller on the line. Caller, what's your name and what's your question?
Hello, this is Dan from Texas.
Dan.
Have you had an opportunity to review the most recent NIST report regarding the global collapse theory of Building 7? And if so, your top one or two issues with that. Thank you.
I prefer not to discuss that right now. I'll be glad to discuss that with you later, like in a week. But it's very concerning that they would put out a report like this. Thermal expansion. If thermal expansion heats things up, all the same, if it's, steel has thermal expansion of 13 microstrain per degree C, and concrete is 12. That's very little difference. So you have to have a huge amount of temperature to get those being a significant different length. But the concrete is horizontal. Okay, just like with the towers, you'd have, the floors, for the vertical pieces. It doesn't make sense. And it's sort of embarrassing to see a scientific establishment put out something like that. It's kind of like, is this a Twilight Zone?
No.
Or is it, are you in candid camera?
Either I'm missing something or you're leading to something that is yet to come, but I go back to the thing that you bring to our mind constantly, and I think it's a good point. Where did the buildings go? And again, you said it wasn't any heat that would have put those buildings to ashes. So then in your mind, what are you thinking it actually is?
It's molecular dissociation.
Okay, so we're saying then that could be by a kind of space beam. Is that it?
That term space beam I've never used. It's a derogatory term, and it's very misleading. It's some type of an energy weapon. It's field effects caused by energy beams or energy fields. There's a directed portion of it because we have the cylindrical holes.
Well, you say you never use that term, but then on your frequently asked questions and our answers, it says, is your space beam hypothesis testable? So that term is used on your very site. So what I'm saying is that what you're thinking, that it is that kind of, I don't know, what would you call it, cosmic outer space or other?
No, that's a frequently asked question. I think, I don't remember that being on there, but the answer would have been, I don't use that term.
Okay, well, I'm just quoting what's on your site, but I'm saying,
that's
what you're thinking?
That someone else has asked. These are literally frequently asked questions. But, hey, you asked about space beams.
Or any kind of beam. I mean, are we back to that point where we're saying
it's energy. It's energy.
It's energy.
Right. And it's not directly connected. It's not like an extension cord running to something. For example, you have a remote control on your TV. It sends a signal through the air to your TV. Or your cell phone, the signal goes up to a satellite and back down someplace else. So that's a directed energy. It's not being used as a weapon, I don't think, unless you're detonating something. But, energy, there's probably all sorts of high-tech weaponry that's been around for quite a while. We just don't see it.
So you're saying it could potentially be air-based, ground-based, basically, it could be, you're just saying that it could be anywhere, not just necessarily in a satellite somewhere, is what I'm hearing, correct?
Oh, yes, correct.
Okay. And with all that, if what I'm hearing you is correct, what you're saying is the dust we saw is the material that should have gone boom down into the bathtub. That it literally...
It should have been beams and other things. There weren't enough beams left.
So if this was around and it got into people's lungs, does it stop disintegrating, or does, once it gets in you, does it, this type of material, what would it do to a person if it got on them or in them? You know, what are the effects of this if you're around it?
Excellent point. If you have material that's still dissociating and breaking down and you inhale it, gosh, I can't imagine what it did to your body, but nothing good. I would think it would cause a lot of cancer. It's going to be, you know, it's probably weird energy effects on a very, very tiny level. They're going to send weird signals to different things.
And this kind of cancer then would not just be for the people at Ground Zero. It would be in the air all through New York, would it not?
Correct. And you know, different people would be affected different ways. When I was there last fall, I noticed there was a traffic cop at the corner of Liberty and Church. He was wearing a yellow rubber hazmat suit. And it was like, you know, 75 or 80 degrees, and people were walking around the background with short-sleeve shirts. It's a sunny day. And there's another photo I have. They're hosing down each other's boots, yellow rubber boots, like rubber hazmat suits. So some people there know what's going on, but when you go to that site, at least for me and other people I've talked with, you get a very sore throat. Your body senses there's something not right there.
But somebody else had told me that as well.
You laying around the ground rust almost instantly.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we only have about 10 minutes. There are a couple other topics here to discuss. One of them is, and I want to keep this one, you know, fairly brief so we can get to the next one, is you had mentioned there was actually a hurricane heading straight for New York on that day, and you also mentioned some magnetometer data.
Yes, thank you. What we saw was evidence of field effects, and lo and behold, there was a field effect. I discovered it when I was looking at, you know, the plume, and I wanted better pictures of the plume, so I went and looked up some weather satellite pictures, and oh my gosh, what is that? There's this huge hurricane, bigger than the square mileage of Katrina, right outside of New York City on 9/11. We had reports of thunder at LaGuardia, JFK, and Newark, New Jersey airports on 9/11. If you have reports of thunder, you have field effects.
Now you're saying the thunder was not at the hurricane, so you're saying that was on a clear area.
Right. The hurricane was just right at the tip of Long Island, the Outer Bands. But there was rain reported on Long Island. And, you know, it's like 500-600 miles in diameter, big, huge thing.
Okay, so for anybody out there listening, why do we care that there was a hurricane out there?
Why did we not hear about it?
Well, what does it have to do with the 9/11? I think that's what Brian's going for.
Right. For the people that maybe don't understand or don't know.
Well, when a storm is coming, people sense it in their joints. A lot of people do. So they're sensing the storm before it gets there. They're sensing something. That's a field effect. And what was also interesting, I looked at this magnetometer data, and right precisely when the North Tower got its hole at 8:46 in the morning, and when the South Tower got its hole, and when the South Tower went poof, when the North Tower went poof, and when Building 7 went poof, there's an abrupt change in the magnetometer chart.
Okay, so what is a magnetometer? What does that mean?
It monitors the Earth's magnetic field, the field strength in different directions, like north, south, east, west, and up, down.
Okay, so there was something in New York that since the buildings collapsed?
These readings were taken in Alaska. So it was strong enough that in Alaska it sensed it.
Okay, so again, how then does that fit in with 9/11? Certainly we weren't told about it, and certainly some people probably, you know, as you said, felt it because of their joints or other type of sensation.
Yeah, but then so much other excitement was going on, they, you know, didn't remember they felt it.
Right. So, but how does that affect then the 9/11 scenario?
Well, when you, like I mentioned, I was looking into John Hutchison's work. How he creates these effects on his samples is interfering electrostatic field with, you know, magnetic field with radio frequency waves. And poof, stuff happens.
So you're saying the static fields would come from the hurricane?
Yeah, I don't know exactly how it works, but, you know, there's in labs, well, we know about Nikola Tesla. And that's, you know, the Tesla coil?
Mm. Right.
If you look at the structure of a hurricane,
it
looks just like a structure of a Tesla coil.
Well, and I saw on your website you'd mentioned that the eye goes to a funny shape, and then right after the building fall, the hurricane turns and goes out the opposite direction.
Yeah, it went straight for several days, right towards New York City, then stops, like at a chalk line there, makes a U-turn, more than a U-turn, and heads straight east.
Okay, so all that's interesting. With the 5 minutes we got left, we'll leave that for the people to look at on the website. You are apparently one of the only people that has a lawsuit out there regarding to 9/11. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Yeah, I can't tell you about too many specifics, but NIST hired contractors to do their investigative report and to write the report on buildings 1 and 2.
Okay, what is NIST? Who is
National Institutes of Standards and Technology.
Okay.
They were asked to figure out why the towers collapsed. Well, first of all, would you believe
the report
contains nothing about why the towers collapsed, even though it's titled The Collapse of the Towers? They quit studying what was going on before the towers went away. So, yeah, the towers were standing until they were no longer standing. And the people who were engaged in that report, the contractors, I believe, did something illegal. They signed off on a report that has bogus conclusions. Like, for example, UL had done fire studies. For 2 hours, they had this mock-up of the floor. And they couldn't get it to fail, so they called the test. If they could not get a single failure, how can they sign off a report saying that fires did it?
Okay, and then how does all this, how does NIST and these reports play back into your lawsuit?
Okay, the QTAM case is about those who have defrauded the government. And it's an avenue, it's about the only avenue we as citizens can take in addressing this. And I would think everyone who cares about the truth about 9/11 would, you know, be just quite interested in how this goes. How many of your tax dollars got wasted? Our tax dollars were spent on this bogus report.
Well, and I did read parts of that report, and I know that they also came out saying that the fire was responsible for everything, which is, to me, bogus as well, but in a little bit of time we have, is there some kind of conclusion you can, you know, advance?
Well, here's an interesting feature. The two biggest contractors that NIST hired are manufacturers and developers of directed energy weapons.
Hmm.
So they knew what they were looking at.
Okay, so my question then is, before we run out of time, Judy, and you've been a wonderful guest, is there some kind of conclusion you could advance about all of this?
We need to look at the data, and the more you look at the data will tell you exactly what happened. If you look at the data, there's plenty of evidence that we have there, and we all need to think for ourselves. I think that's the most important thing, because that's why this 9/11 happened.
What does the data tell you what happened? You're the expert here, so what does the data tell you?
The data tells me it's molecular dissociation, something that caused the I didn't know about any of this until I started looking into it, but the data told me this, that something, an energy field caused the building, instead of the holding together, it separated matter. And I think the key is free energy. this is indicative that free energy is available to all, and it was used on 9/11.
Well, and you know, I think you may be absolutely right about that, because certainly what happened at those towers defied physics, that as we understand it to be. Is that not true?
As we understand, but if you know about this other method, it doesn't defy physics.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a more complex form of physics, because
you're saying it goes
into the assumptions you're making, you know, wouldn't be correct. The building did not fall as a chunk. It just came apart and snowed down as dust.
So what you're saying is Tesla technology, you believe, possibly exists and in a more advanced form than is out in the public. Is that what I'm hearing?
Yes. Thank you. Correct.
But we're saying, though, Tesla, I mean, his technology we've used through HARP and ELF and other electromagnetic waves and various. So this is not a far reach for that type of technology, would it be?
Correct. And the magnetometer data is just so striking. It's pretty much kind of flat up until, you know, about 8:20 in the morning, and then it starts charging up, that's what it looks like.
Hmm.
And then it goes just haywire all over the place.
Well, you know, I think we're going to have to get you back on, Judy, because you have been an excellent guest, and I'm certainly grateful for your appearance, and I certainly thank Brian for helping with this as well. And, you know, I think you position a very good philosophy, and I think that's something we need to look at, because there's not been a real explanation for what has happened to those towers.
If you look at, yeah, I've got plenty of pictures there, and I invite everyone to just look at them, and they'll tell you what happened. Especially those pictures with the fuzzy stuff around the feet.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, why did the dust settle out so quickly and then become fine?
Well, thank you again, Judy. You were wonderful.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
It was our pleasure. And listeners, stay tuned to Don DiMaggio, who has eyewitness viewpoint from Shanksville, where the Flight 93 crashed. Hold on, we're coming right back. All right, listeners, this is Dr. Gianni Hayes with Brian Davis, and we are back with our second guest for 9/11. And again, please, if you get a chance, go to American Voice Radio, and you could get on in a chat room there. You could call in 1-800-433-1429 to talk to our guest, and buy those cell phone filters, please. Our second guest is Dominic DiMaggio, and he is from Pennsylvania, and he's been a researcher of Shanksville. And if you recall, listeners, Shanksville is where Flight 93 crashed, or presumably crashed, coming from the Pittsburgh area. So Mr. DiMaggio has been researching 9/11 for over 4 years, and he's had his hands on this research that has had him traveling to various places and talking to many eyewitnesses who each tell different stories about what really went on that day. And he says he's one of the few who knows what happened in Somerset County. And, you know, you can go and see him online at various YouTubes. And, you know, for me to give out all of those URLs will take forever. But Brian, I'm sure, was going to have them up on the website very soon, but one is called the Shanksville Eyewitnesses, and another one is The Death of Freedom in America, and he's working on some other ones as we speak. And again, all you have to do is go to YouTube, and if you want to put DiMaggio in there, Dominic DiMaggio, you can certainly get lots of answers that way. He received 2 credits for his contributions to Loose Change, Final Cut, along with credit for his contributions to Pilots for 9/11 Truth, and you know about that, listeners. I've had several 9/11 Pilots for Truth on my show, as well as Citizens Investigation Team. In the past few months, he says he will release additional interviews covering the Shanksville eyewitness testimonies. He gives answers to questions we're all asking. If the crater, for example, was only 6 or 8 feet deep in Somerset, and 20 feet wide, how do you fit 100 tons of aircraft into such a low-volume area? And the alleged 37 passengers, including the alleged 4 hijackers and 7 crew members, which totaled 44, with their seats, will not fit into that small hole. At least to my accounting, it didn't. So where did the rest of the alleged 757 aircraft go? And why were there no human remains? And so Mr. DiMaggio is going to address some of these questions. Welcome, Dominic.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be on.
And Brian Davis is my co-host here tonight. Brian, you want to say hello?
Hi, Dominic. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Brian. Thanks.
So, Dominic, now, were you there on the site? Well, first let me say, you can tell the listeners about your video. I didn't want to give out all the URLs, but you have a site where they can go to and look at your videos?
You know what? They can go to Google Video, type in 9/11 Shanksville Eyewitness, and you'll come across there's Susan McElwain and Wally Miller interviews. Those are up on there now. So those two are the ones to go watch. They're both about 40 minutes long or so.
Okay. Where were you when all this happened in Somerset?
I was at work that day. I worked right outside of Pittsburgh.
Okay. And so did you see the plane at all? Or a plane?
No, I didn't. That day I didn't. After the second tower was hit, I told my boss, I was like, I'm going home. And I went home. It was so eerie driving home that day because I take the turnpike and everything, and there was no cars out anywhere. And then by the time I got home and turned the news on, Flight 93 had already gone down, and, you know, there was all these reports of people on the news that day, the eyewitness were talking about, you know, they saw this military plane in this. And to me, that day, I was just like, well, yeah, okay, they shot it down. I turned the channel to see what was going on at the Pentagon and the World Trade Center. Like, it just was like, okay, they shot that plane down. There's, you know, no story there.
So then you took it upon yourself then to interview the people in the area who were presumably eyewitnesses to the event, right?
Yeah.
How many did you interview, do you think?
I've spoken to anywhere so far between over 12 to 15 different eyewitnesses.
Okay, and maybe you can give us a sense of what some of them say.
It's a lot of people aren't willing to come forward as much, but this white plane that we all heard about that they ended up coming out saying it was a Falcon 20, this corporate plane that was flown by a pilot named Yates Gladwell, they all say it was definitely not a corporate jet. Everybody out here agrees to it. That saw the little white plane, which is just about anybody who walked outside their house within 2 minutes of that explosion saw this plane.
So you're saying it wasn't a 757?
The plane that was definitely seen afterwards, definitely not. It was some kind of small military white, all white, had no markings. Susan McElwain, I interviewed her on the location where she saw it, and she saw it in Stoystown, which is, she was about a little bit southwest, about a mile southwest of where the crater was. And she pulls up to a stop sign, and she comes to a stop, and as she's sitting there, like, she says this thing comes flying in right above her van. She looks, and the trees ahead of us are probably right across the street, are about 40, 45 feet in height. And she says the plane had to pull up to not hit those trees. That's how low this little white plane was flying. And she's like, I watched him. He banked up over the trees there, and he headed off towards where the crash site would be. She goes, and when he was out of sight, there was an explosion. She's like, I watched him pull up, and I said, oh, my God, he's going to crash. He's going to crash. And then it was out of sight, and there was the explosion.
So, okay, let me first straight. You're saying there were presumably two planes. The one that
was
the 757 that everybody was told crashed in Shanksville, and then you're saying there was a smaller plane that ensued, right?
Yeah, that was at the scene at the same exact moment, without a doubt. I have three eyewitnesses that put it at the scene. One woman, after she heard the thud, walked out of her house, ran out of her house to see what it was, and actually saw the little white plane flying above the area before the smoke plume rose up.
Okay, two planes you're seeing at the very same time.
Yeah, the thing is, people who are south of the crash site and west of it see the little white plane. The people who are north and kind of east all see what's presumably to be Flight 93.
That's interesting.
And they're on pretty much a head-on collision course.
For each other. Head-on to each other.
Yes, and they both get to the same spot at the same time, just only one of them is seen afterwards. And the other one, we're trying to figure out how it disappears in an 8-foot hole.
So there are two planes, they're headed for each other, and then the small one makes suddenly this appearance that is still there. It remains, but the 757 is gone.
It is no longer seen, yeah.
But there was no crash.
The people to the south who saw the little white plane never saw the 757. Like, Susan McElwain was a mile away staring in that general direction, and she didn't see the 757 coming down out of the sky like she was supposed to. So how she could miss a 757, like, not even a mile from her, you know, coming down out of the sky, like, that's a sight, especially when she's already staring in that direction because she's looking at that little white plane.
So you interviewed 12 people, Dom. Then would you say it was evenly split? Who saw both planes, or did more see one plane and not the other? Did anybody see the 757 crash?
Lee Perbaugh allegedly was at the field and saw Flight 93 crash there. Now, he had agreed he was going to meet me. We were going to go out to the site. He was going to tell me the story. He was going to let me film it. All this and that. He agreed he was going to do all of this. And then, like, a couple days before I went out there, a certain internet persona had contacted him and started asking him some questions and recorded those conversations and put them up on the internet. And then he, I called him up and said, listen, I want to tell you I recorded our phone calls. It was wrong of me. I put it on the internet, this and that. So when I went to meet Lee Perbaugh 2 days later and I contacted him, Lee's like, I have an attorney, and he advised me not to speak with you.
You taped his phone calls and put it on the internet without his permission?
I didn't know. I had nothing to do with that, no.
Okay.
I was going out to meet him, and 2 days before that, someone else started contacting him and did that.
Okay. Okay.
And so, because of that, when I went to meet him, because there was no need for me to do that, he was going to meet me in person and let me film him, and it was all agreed to, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, so he was the only person I know of that was there to see it allegedly hit the ground.
Of the 12 people you interviewed, he was the only one.
Yeah. I had, I talked to two guys who saw Flight 93. And that was, their names, Bob Blair and Doug Miller. And they both saw it. They were on Route 30. They were traveling east, said it was in front of them. And when they saw it flying, they said the wings were like at a 90-degree angle where they were vertical to the ground, but the plane was not upside down. And they saw it. They said it was still at a good height. It was coming down in that direction. And they said it disappeared behind the trees because of the way the elevation of the land is. They were like, we couldn't see it anymore. We just saw the smoke come up, and so we drove there. And as they were approaching the scene, they actually passed Lee Perbaugh. They told me, well, they don't know who Lee Perbaugh was. They told me, you know, we were getting there, and there was one guy in a truck leaving, and he stopped, and he's like, hey, a plane went down and over there, and he jumped back in his truck, and he took off. I assume that to be Lee Perbaugh because he's the only person that was supposed to have been out there in the field to see it. But Bob and Doug got there, and they told me, you know, we were pretty much the second and third guy who got there on the scene that day. And the thing that really amazed me is they said they put the they had a fire extinguisher with in their truck, and they put the fires out with their fire extinguisher before even Stoystown Fire Department arrived.
Now wait, who said that they put the fires out?
Bob Blair and Doug Miller.
Okay, so they're saying that there was a crash and there was a fire, or did they not see the crash but only the fire?
They saw the plane go down in that direction, and then they lost it behind the trees because of the elevation. So, you know, they assumed that it had crashed. One of them even told me that they actually looked at the other one and said, you know, because they couldn't figure out where the plane went, do you think he could have pulled out of that?
Hmm.
And they're like, well, no, I mean, what happened here? What crashed here? You know, look, there's something. They said they saw, because I asked them what they saw, like, debris-wise? And he said there was a tire that was burning, and they said we couldn't get the tire out. We kept trying. We got everything else out. He goes, we'd get that tire, and it would just light right back up. He goes, there was that. He goes, there was something that looked like maybe a gearbox. He goes, and other than that, he goes, it was scrap.
Now, enough scrap to be a plane, or what?
Definitely seeing the pictures I saw that Wally Miller took, which I had a chance to go through hundreds of his photographs.
You need to tell the listeners who Wally Miller is, and isn't he the, I wouldn't say...
The coroner.
Yeah.
Yeah. And going through his and seeing what debris was outside of the crate, I mean, there definitely wasn't enough outside to account for a 757. The story that there's debris, you know, 50 feet down and 70 feet down. I mean, I heard these stories. I see the crater. It's 8 feet deep. I don't know. Like, I mean, they said they got stuff out deeper, but they didn't document anything that they removed from inside of that crater. When I asked even Wally Miller, because he told me, you know, remains were recovered inside the crater and outside the crater, I said, well, you know, did you photograph the remains inside the crater before they removed, or the FBI? I said, what was the documentation process done on that? He was like, there wasn't any.
So he just said that there were remains, and did he not say, I believe, that they had vaporized, though? That they
they got enough to account for about 8% of the passengers. The FBI seemed to bring a lot into the DeMort lab where he was set up, and they brought in hands and feet, and he was explaining to me that somehow the tendons play a part in why there were so many hands and feet recovered. But he said other than that, he goes, there's pretty much nothing, and he showed me photographs of human remains at the actual crash site. And the remains that I saw could pretty much be attributed to about one human being.
Brian?
Well,
I think you're stunned over there, Brian.
Every time I hear him ask a question, he answers it. So.
When we talk about this, and then there seems to be a discrepancy, Dom, about what plane went really down, if there really was a plane that went down, how soon after supposedly this 757 crash did the government, you know, just zoom in on the site and start to remove things? Was it immediately or what?
They kind of sealed off the areas on the 11th, and pretty much on the 12th is when they really began the cleanup. It wasn't as quickly as what was done in the Pentagon where you saw, you know, quick, like immediately afterwards, there was just lines of people going across the grass picking up every single piece of everything they could find. It seemed like this happened a little bit, it took a little bit of time before that started. But then when they actually went and did that, they did it in a hurried manner, and they did the whole scene with, I mean, there was no crash scene that was ever documented this poorly, ever.
Okay, so
I started asking Wally Miller about, you know, did they grid off the area? Because that's normally like, my best friend, his father was a chief of police for over 20 years, and then he went into being a EMT. And when Flight 427 crashed coming out of Pittsburgh, it crashed out here in Aliquippa in 1994. He worked the scene. He told me how they made all these, like, they were pretty much like, I think he said they were either 24-inch or 36-inch grids, where they did put little stakes in the ground, and they strung the area up, and they, you know, they photographed it, and they documented here was remains, here were plane parts, and this and that. And Wally Miller was like, when I asked him, you know, did you guys do this kind of documentation on the site? He was like, well, no, the FBI just said there wasn't the kind of, he goes, I wanted to do that, but the FBI said there wasn't the manpower to do it.
Well, you know, you're talking about Aliquippa and Pittsburgh. I'm from Pittsburgh, so I know exactly what you're referring to. But I'm envisioning this site up in Somerset, and I have been to Somerset countless times, where there's this hole, and presumably this plane, a huge plane, 757, went in. So from the time that happened, and you saw, you were driving home, and you heard that there was this crash in Shanksville, was the government right there instantly, or was there a period of time, an hour or 5 hours, before anybody converged on the site and started to clean it up?
It was probably, I would say, 45 minutes to an hour before probably the FBI started showing up there.
And Wally Miller, who supposedly, you know, was the medical examiner for all of this, he collected, what was it, DNA? Did he do the actual DNA testing, or did the government collect it?
Well, see, that's what I thought at first was, you know, he's the coroner of the scene. He would be the one who would remove all the remains. Then after talking to him, what I got was he did the identification, but it seemed more like the FBI was bringing into him. That they were out saying, oh, we recovered this here and we recovered that here. Here you go.
So, in other words, the government actually is the one that came out and said that they did the testing and they took the DNA and they came out with the results that said, yep, there were bodies there and they were essentially vaporized except for some arms and legs, and that's how they made the DNA identification?
Pretty much. Like, I think Wally Miller, he claims to have identified all of them. But from what I gathered in news reports and that when it first happened, I think the number of people he probably identified is more like 14 or 15. And the rest of them were sent off to the Armed Forces Medical Examiner's lab out in Maryland. I think it's in Rockford, if I remember correctly. And the rest of them, because they had much better, you know, facilities for this, allegedly, that's where these remains ended up, and that's where the rest of them got identified.
But how would he identify it, though, Don? Because he doesn't have any sophisticated lab there in Shanksville.
The FBI was bringing him in the samples to test it against. They were collecting, the FBI was allegedly collecting the samples from the family members, and, you know, they brought up the equipment for him. And they sent him up a temporary lab there, and they brought him in all kinds of help, and they brought him the DNA samples to test against, and they brought him the list of names of who he was going to find. And so at times, like, a lot of people thought Wally Miller was complicit, but I think if he is involved in any kind of cover-up, I think he was pretty much duped into it himself.
Meaning he didn't know any better himself.
Yeah. Yeah, too trusting.
Okay. Have you talked to any of the families, victims of the families?
No.
No.
No. That I wouldn't know where to begin. Like, I wanted to contact Edward Felt's family because there's a report about he called Westmoreland County from the bathroom. And he told... Yeah, the guy who took the call, the operator, his name was John Shaw. He told him that, you know, there had been an explosion and that there was white smoke in the plane. And then shortly after that, the call ended up, they ended up losing contact.
Well, the reason I ask that is there's certainly a lot of question, and I know you know this, about 9/11, where there really families who had, in other words, if there really was a plane or planes that hit the towers, mm-hmm. And the victims then have family members, but the families don't seem to be wanting to talk about anything. So when you went to Shanksville, I think that testimony might have been really good if you could talk to the victims' families and say, you know, what did the FBI tell you? You know, when did you get word of this? You know, did you really lose somebody in a loved one there?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, do you think it's feasible that there weren't any real bodies there?
I mean, it's definitely feasible. I mean, when you look at the crater and it's 8 feet deep, it's maybe 15, 20 feet wide. And, like, I saw the photos of the human remains that were collected at the site. And like I said, this is what was collected that I saw actual photos of. There was a left arm. It was probably from the forearm up to the fingertips. There was... it looked like a scalp, like a human scalp. It was hair, and it was, you could just tell what it was. And then there was pretty much, looked like a couple charred finger bones and an organ that was either probably a lung or a heart. And that was it. For 44 people, human remains photographed outside the crash site by the coroner, where he says, you know, they were recovered outside the crater and inside the crater. Outside, that was all that I saw that was photographed. Now, he told me he had different pictures that were in files, and they were attributed to each passenger, but for some reason, all those files were naturally kept at a different location. How convenient that turned out to be.
Have you been approached by anybody from the government or FBI?
No.
So you don't pose any threat to them, that they're not concerned that you're over here saying what a lot of us are thinking is what really went on at that site, since apparently there wasn't.
I think I might be too cool and too well known for a lot of people who are interested, definitely in like the Shanksville aspect of 9/11 research, definitely know my name. So I think kind of in that way, I'm kind of like safer now.
Why would you say you're safer? I don't want to, you know.
Just I feel a little more secure because I'm a public person whose name's out there and known. And if I disappear tomorrow, people are going to notice. Where if I wasn't such a public figure and I disappear, I would be more worried if people didn't notice if I vanished. I mean, that's a chance everyone's got to take when you're doing this kind of stuff. It's like, there could come a time where something very bad can happen to you. That's a very possible reality, but you got to do what you got to do if you believe. I mean,
yeah.
If I didn't have the questions and then go out and try to get the answers and I just sat here, I feel like I'd be selling my children, like I would be letting them. And I feel part of the reason why this government and this country is in such poor shape is because my parents really didn't care, and that's how they let me down. They were more part of the who cares, forget it, drop out. You know what I mean? That whole scene.
Well, your parents didn't care about you, so you feel that you have an obligation for your children.
That they didn't care about their rights and what the government and politicians were doing around them. You know, the whole establishment was just like, not that it wasn't about me, that it was, you know, they weren't concerned in world affairs and current domestic affairs, and that allowed such a level of corruption to continue to grow. And I believe there's a lot of corruption in our government, and that there's ways to expose it. And if they're covering things up, I think, you know, that's which is in the dark should be brought out into the light.
Well, I would agree with you, and I think Brian would agree with you too. The problem is that I think in the past, you know, our parents probably were not even aware of that the government was doing these things, if they are doing these things. So that's probably why, you know, they didn't do anything about it. And they were very trusting.
True.
You know, they were very trusting. They thought the government was there and they were the good guys. And, you know, we wonder differently. But when you go to that site now, Dom, what
mm-hmm.
do you see? Can you get to that crater?
Oh, no, it's fenced off. They have us armed guards there, too. Because I've gone back in the area you're not supposed to go back into, because that's just how I am. And I tried to get closer because they keep you so far away, and it's like I'm not trying to get up, you know, to the actual site. But it's like, man, I'm like 500 yards away. Can I get a little bit closer to see this, you know, to pay respect, whatever? And just to see how small it is. And I was I was about 100 yards away. I was there with one of the guards that was working the site. I told him what I was doing. I was like, look, I just came back here. I said, you can stand here. I'm not making a run for it. I said, I'm not going out to desecrate anything or nothing like that. So I'm just going to take a few pictures and a little bit of video, and then I'm going to get in my car and I'm going to drive away. And he was real cool about it. So that was cool. And as I was standing there, I mean, the whole place is just fenced off back there. The closer you get, it really puts into perspective how small that area is. I mean, right now it's kind of like it's a little chunk of grass. And
all right, Dom,
a lighter
we want
green
you to hold
rest.
That thought for a minute. We have to go to station identification, so just hold on. Listeners, we're coming right back, aren't we, Brian?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, listeners, we are back, and we are live. This is New World Order Disorder on the American Voice Radio Network. You are listening to Dr. Hayes and Brian Davis, and you can call in live at 1-800-433-1429. Our special guest tonight is Dominic DiMaggio. We're discussing September 11th in Shanksville. And, Dominic, I want to ask you kind of a two-part question. The first part is, did a plane crash, or where did this plane go, and whether it did or didn't, what was the white plane doing there?
Good question.
Yes, those are great questions. Did the plane crash? Well, here's the thing. I talked to Doug Miller and Bob Blair, who were north of the crash site, who told me they saw a commercial airliner that was, you know, it was pretty much flying on its side towards the site. It went out of sight. They couldn't actually see an impact. On the other side, I got Susan McElwain, who should see the 757 coming at her. But for some reason, she doesn't see it. And she sees a little white plane that is flying instead of what should be Flight 93 should be coming south. She sees a little white plane that is flying north. I know for a fact that the little white plane is at the crash site at that moment, because one woman I spoke to, who I'm going to release the interview. I'm not going to release her name yet because she asked me not to. She's kind of nervous and she wants to think things out. So, but she heard the actual impact or explosion. She said it was a thud. And she said, wow, what was that? And she ran outside her house and she said, I saw that little, well, I said to her, I said, so you saw the little white plane in the sky? She started laughing like nervously. And she's like, yeah, I saw that. And I said, what did you see? She's like, well, when I went outside, she's like, the little white plane was there. She's like, and then I could see the smoke rise up. So I know when the explosion happened, the white plane was directly above the crash site. I know for a fact the white plane was. I don't know the 757 was. I just know the 757 was headed in that direction. Lee Purdball is the guy who allegedly saw it impact the ground. He was going to speak to me, but he's got an attorney. He won't talk.
Okay, so what in your mind was this little white plane doing? Was it just chasing to see what was coming, or did it fire a missile at a plane, fire a missile at the ground, project a hologram? What was it doing?
It's hard for me to speculate, but based on the four descriptions I have from eyewitnesses, one of them is, you can read it, different accounts online, and you can't really get much out of it, but another guy, his name's Rick Cheney. The plane is definitely some kind of, like, classified military plane. I don't know what it would have been doing, because all of these people told me the one thing that really bothered them is the plane, when it was flying, was silent. This little white plane made no noise whatsoever. And again, all four of them said that to me.
And like, did anybody ever identify the type of plane?
No, the one woman told me, she said, after it happened, she goes, I almost lost my job because I had spent months. She's like, every hour I could when I was at work, I was doing it. She goes, I was going and looking at pictures of planes and trying to find a picture so that I could tell someone this is what I saw. And she goes, and there isn't a picture of it. She's like, but I know what I saw. And then I told her about Susan McElwain, and she was like, I told her what Susan described. She's like, that's exactly. The difference was that she could see it from the top. And Susan, it flew over her. She only had a bottom view. And she told me that she saw it like it had like a little window. She's like, I think there could have been a pilot in it, because there was a window, and Rick Cheney told me there was a window. I said, but do you think, you know, I said, was it this corporate plane? She's laughed. She's like, no, it is definitely not. She's like, there was, if there was one person in it, that was it. She was like, I don't even believe you could put a second person in it. It was so small. And I was like, Susan McElwain said the plane was, you know, not much wider than her van. She's like, well, that sounds about right for the width. So if you can start to envision how small this plane really has to be.
So, you know, it's interesting you're saying all of this, Dom, because I don't know if you heard our guest who was on before, who posited a theory that there was some kind of energy beam that may have brought down the Twin Towers. Could this be the case here, that there was some kind of energy beam either from that white plane or wherever that could have brought down a 757? But in my mind, I'm still not convinced there was a 757.
I definitely haven't seen enough debris in my mind to account for a 757. I've gone as far as to theorize. I don't know if you know the contradiction in the way the passengers were boarded, the story that got out. You know, initially it was like they boarded traditionally the way you would at any other airplane, but then this obscure story showed up in out of Fayetteville, and a guy who grew up in Fayetteville ended up playing football for the New York Giants. And the night before, on September 10th, the Giants were in Denver, I think it was. They played a game against the Broncos, a Monday night game, and they arrived at Newark the next morning, and they got there shortly before 8 o'clock, their plane got there. And as they're sitting on the runway and they're waiting there, they're looking out the window, and they see this commercial airliner, and there's the passengers are boarding it out on the tarmac out there. And it kind of like everyone's just kind of looking out the window because they've never, like, seen anybody board a plane like that out at Newark International.
Mm-hmm.
And 2 weeks later, they go to fly out of town. And the steward, their flight crew, says, you know, hey, you remember when we landed last Tuesday and we saw that plane, we were all watching the people board up on the out there on the tarmac. And they were like, yeah. They're like, she's like, well, that's the plane that went down in Pennsylvania. And the player, his name's Clayton White, he's like, he was talking about playing with the Giants, and he's like, that's the memory I have the most of New York, was that story right there. And we actually tracked him down. He's coaching in college football now. And we actually tracked him down just to get confirmation that, you know, that story was true, that that's exactly what happened. That's what they saw. That's what the flight attendant told them. And, you know, it was their normal crew. They had a crew that worked all the flights for the team and this and that. And he confirmed it all back to us, and he was like, listen, he started realizing why we were asking questions. He kind of got a little bit nervous about it. But, yeah, so I theorized at one point to account for how this plane disappeared was that these people boarded it out there because it had been modified in some aspect where maybe it had some type of explosives on it, some kind of bomb, so that when it would reach its destination, it would guarantee that there would be no evidence left of it as well. And, you know, I mean, because I haven't found a witness yet that tell me they saw the 757 fly away. And that's the problem I have, because I found people who saw it head that way. And I have people on the other side. I mean, they didn't see it fly away, but what they saw was definitely not a 757, and it was headed in the same direction.
Right, so we have a situation now where we're saying there was this plane that was boarding passengers, but not in a conventional way, and yet that may have been the plane that went down, the 757, but yet we don't see any wreckage at the site that indicates there was a 757, and certainly the natural markings, such as a crater that would have held that, and would not the plane, if it were 757, gone much deeper? Maybe did it go into the ground? Could that have been what they're talking about?
I don't know. I don't believe that it went in. I talked to a guy, his name was John Maslick, and he lived in Central City, and after it happened, he got out. He's like, I just ran outside. He's like, and I saw smoke coming up. I jumped in my vehicle, and I drove out there. He's like, I got there. He's like, I got there before Storystown got there. He goes, there's probably about 10 or 12 people out there when I arrived. And I said, this was one of the first people I talked to, and I said to him, I was like, so this was my first, this was probably my second time I drove out to Shanksville. This was one of the first eyewitnesses I had ever met to any part of it. And I was waiting for him to tell me about, seeing something of the plane that we didn't see in a picture or something anywhere. And I'm like, he looked at me and he's just like, man, he's like, there was no plane in that hole. He's like, I stood there. He goes, that hole, he goes, it was the size of a plane's engine. He's like, and they're telling me a 757 went down. He goes, and I was standing there looking at that hole, and I was just like, no. He's like, and to this day, it bothers me. He goes, because I stood out. He goes, I've flown on a lot of airplanes. He goes, I know how big they are. He goes, and I know how small that hole was. And I can't believe a 757 disappeared. He goes, it wasn't even 10 feet deep. He's like, that's a lot of plane to disappear in 10 feet.
Well, so it certainly couldn't have gone into the ground very deep.
Somehow, I guess I'm going to say the conspiracy theorists theorize that the ground swallowed this plane and then sealed itself up.
That's what I was getting to. Yeah,
left an indention that looked like the plane went only so far and stopped.
Mm-hmm.
That's their theory. And somehow underneath that, even though you can see the crater floor, underneath that's all the plane and you just can't see it. So we dig it out.
Well,
I call that a conspiracy theory.
Yeah. Well, but I know that's what people have said about that, and
yeah.
That's why I wanted to bring that to your attention in those terms is how do people, get past with that kind of theory when the hole still isn't big enough and apparently there is not anything in that hole. Isn't that what you're saying?
No, scrap. There's some scrap. I mean, there's an engine that we saw in a photo that the people I talked to didn't see. I mean, and it looks like when they're excavating it, and still you can see it's partially in the ground, it looks like it's only like 3 or 4 feet deep. If an engine's only getting 3 or 4 feet deep in the ground, then like the tail section's not getting 60 feet down. It's nonsense.
And there was no rainstorm or anything that would have softened the ground, right?
No.
Just to consider every aspect of this. You live in a town, Shanksville. It's not a very big town, and a lot of people know you there, Dom. What is the general feeling of the townspeople of what happened that day? Because it certainly disrupted their lives.
There's a couple people who are, and I'm kind of suspicious that they definitely know more than they say, but there's a couple people who recite the official story hook, line, and sinker, and get real mad if you say anything to the contrary. And then there's the rest of the people who tell stories that contradict it, and a lot of them say, one guy told me, he's like, listen, he goes, I didn't see plane, the guys who were north of it, they said, I didn't see parts coming off that plane. And I'm like, all right. He goes, but, a lot of people out here pretty much believe it was shot down. And I asked them, I said, well, did you see any other planes? And they were, Bob and Doug, they were like, no, I didn't, see any. And but when I got down to the crash site, they said, which was probably 2 or 3 minutes later, they said a huge white military plane came. And he said it scared the hell out of us. It was like right above the trees. He goes, I've never seen a plane this big. He goes, and it was white and it had no more. And I started to think, because it was driving me nuts. I talked to Doug, and I was telling Doug, I was like, yeah, Bob told me about this white plane, the big white plane you guys saw afterwards. He's like, yeah. He goes, and I said, when I come out to meet you, can you maybe draw me a picture of it? He goes, I want to help you guys figure out what it is. Doug said, Bob said he don't know what kind of plane it was. He's like, well, yeah, I can do that, but the FBI stopped out here, and they already told me what it was. And I asked him, I said, well, what did they say? And he goes, they told me it was one of them C-130 cargo planes that fly around. And I said, oh. I said, so it had, two big propellers each of the wings. And he was like, no. I said, it didn't have any propellers? He's like, no, it didn't have propellers. I said, well, C-130 cargo planes have propellers on it. He's like, well, what I saw didn't have propellers, but they said it was a C-130.
But you, we're talking a big white plane, but earlier you said, Dom, there was a small white plane.
Small white plane. This is another plane that arrives about 3 minutes afterwards. There were so many planes converging on this site, it's unreal.
Okay, let me make sure I have this. There, supposedly there was the 757 and the small white plane that presumably, and I say this allegedly, we don't know, crashed. And then you're saying following the crash, there was a large white plane?
Another large white plane that arrived about 3 minutes later. It came to the southeast. One of the people that witnessed it, that you can kind of go look up and online on, you can Google their name, is Paul Muro, M-U-R-O, and you can hear his account about how after it happened, he watched this, you know, large white plane come out of the southeast, and it kind of went up to the site, and it kind of circled around, and it went back to the southeast. And for a while there, after talking to him and talking to Doug, I started to think, for some reason, that I believe it's the Doomsday plane. I believe it got to Shanksville about 2 or 3 minutes after the event there, the one that they saw in D.C. minutes after the Pentagon.
Doomsday meaning what?
What's that?
What do you mean by doomsday plane?
The E-4B, the U.S. Military plane, that's kind of like, it's pretty much where if we were under an attack, and you wanted to get people, like, up in the air and keep government functioning, and that way you would put them in the E-4B. It's called the Doomsday Plane. And it got that nickname because when it was designed, I think it was in the 80s, it was designed in case of, you know, a full nuclear war and everything, that I guess this was what they were going to start running the government out of.
Mm-hmm. So you
and
think
this
that's
was
what it was?
Filmed. There's actually, if you've seen the film of a white plane, attributed to being over the Pentagon or over the White House a couple minutes after the attack on the Pentagon. That was the Doomsday plane that it was caught in D.C. on film.
Well, you know, the thing with the D.C., I had a guest on who also said that there were two planes at the Pentagon site as well. And one plane supposedly was the crash plane, which people say never crashed, but there was another plane that came right after it. And it went off to one side, and the one that was supposed to crash into the Pentagon went over the Pentagon, but there were, again, two planes.
Yeah, that's that I'm not too familiar with. I know the people I recommend is a citizen investigation team for the Pentagon, and they pretty much have enough witnesses that they proved the plane did not fly on the official flight path that allegedly knocked down Lake Poles and Lloyd the cab driver, the whole stage, that whole scene is staged. And the plane approached from a different side on a different flight path and flew over it, and they actually got one of the police officers that was at the Pentagon actually see the silver commercial airliner flying away after hearing the explosion that caused him to run outside to look past the impact point. So I definitely know about the one that flew over. I don't know about the second plane, though.
Go ahead, Brian.
I was just going to say what's interesting about these, especially the one there in Shanksville, they found a burning tire, maybe a part of an engine, did not find really any of the rest of the plane, but yet they have the black boxes from at least that one in the Pentagon. Is that correct?
Yeah, they allegedly both black boxes from each crash, but they couldn't find anything at the World Trade Center.
So they couldn't find the rest of the plane, but they did find the black box.
Yeah.
Which was inside the plane that they can't find.
The plane recovered like 90-some percent of Flight 93.
Oh, you're saying they recovered 90% of it?
I'm not saying that. They claim. I haven't seen any proof to support 90% of a 757 being recovered anywhere. Just a statement from the government saying that's what we got.
Well, the pictures, there's nothing there to recover.
No, there's scrap.
When you look at the crash site, it's just a hole in the ground.
It's
like a farmer blew
a
bump out of the field.
It's like little, I don't know, 6-inch by like 10-inch little pieces of silver. And that's the other thing that bothers me. A lot of it, if you really study the pictures, isn't gray or blue. It's silver.
What's silver?
The debris, the little scraps that you see scattered about outside of the crash site.
Mm-hmm.
a lot of it, like over, I'm going to say almost all of it's silver. Where you should see like a dark gray or, you know, the blue, the United colors. The only thing I found, there's like two pieces, or no, there's one piece that shows all three colors conveniently enough. But it's just kind of photographed as the piece. You can't even get an idea of where it is, you know, like it's not taken at an angle where you can see, oh, there's the burnt trees or there's the crater or anything like that, where you can actually attribute it to somewhere at that site.
Well, you know, you've done a lot of research on this, Dom, in your mind, and you've talked to people. So in your mind, what do you think happened? I mean, nobody's holding you to your own theory here, but we're just wondering, since you've talked to people, you get a pretty much a good feel of what people are saying, what they believe, how the town is reacting, what the government story is. What do you think it is?
Well, the majority of the people out there believe it was a shoot down that I've spoken with. The woman who actually, that I told you about earlier, that actually places a little white plane directly above the smoke plume when she walks outside, she actually sees it before the smoke plume, she's angry about there being a cover-up. She's angry about, you know, them lying in a corporate plane, and she says they need to come out and just tell everybody they shot it down and this and that, but there's no, the 757, I don't understand. I don't really so much have a theory other than the official theory is not true, because I can't explain where the plane that Bob and Doug and these guys saw went, and I can't explain how it disappeared in an 8-foot hole either. Like, I don't believe that happened, but I haven't found someone yet who saw it flying away. So, I mean, we can theorize that, you know, there was some kind of advanced weapon on this small plane, this classified plane. We could theorize that maybe this plane was actually headed towards, I mean, Congress, to take out Congress, so Bush could have implemented martial law, and the passengers really did revolt, and that's why they had to shoot it down. Maybe there was, you know, explosives, a bomb, something on side of the plane, so that when it did reach its original destination, it would do even more damage. There's a lot of theories. The one I don't believe is that, you know, three or four Arab guys got real scared and decided to abort the mission into a big empty field.
Well, you know, and of course that's the television version of
what
that supposedly is, and I think that most people don't believe that anyways. But, you know, is it even feasible, and in my mind I try to figure this out too, that the plane existed, the passengers were on it, but they really sent that, they diverted that plane to elsewhere, who knows, maybe into the ocean, and they put another plane over that did not crash but did a hologram. I mean, that's something I've thrown out.
That's possible. I mean, to me, that's definitely more believable than a 757 disappearing into an 8-foot hole. And like I was arguing with this one person about it. I'm like, it's 100 tons. I'm like, if you take 100 tons and you slam it into the ground, I said, I'm going to just be on, even like, give you a decent amount and say half of the ground, 50 tons of dirt needs to get displaced to accommodate the 100 tons you just forced into it. It's like if you had a bucket of sand filled to the top and you pushed a brick into it.
Okay.
Enough sand's going to come up out of that bucket to accommodate the brick.
Right.
It doesn't happen.
Tell me
it
something.
It doesn't happen. There's a little hill, probably 5 or 6 feet high, if that.
All right, tell me something, Dom, because this is really important. When the plane crashed, of course, there had to be a funeral because there certainly were passengers on there and maybe even some people from Somerset. Do you remember if anybody in your town lost any family, relative, friend, somebody they actually knew on that plane?
Oh, definitely not. I actually live about half hour north of Pittsburgh, so I'm about 2 hours north of Shanksville. But when I spoke to some of them, like Susan McElwain, she goes, the thing that bothers me, she goes, every so often someone like you shows up at my door or calls my house and says, you know, can I ask you a question about what you saw? She goes, but it's never a family member.
Don, you were a great guest, Dominic. We appreciate it. Brian, and I thank you very much. Listeners,
thank you.
Brian, we have another great show for 9/11 next week, don't we?
Yes, ma'am, we do. Looking forward to it.
Everybody, come back, and thank you for listening. God bless from Brian and me. Thank you, Dom.